This is the first part of the Delp family history as transcribed from a cassette tape made around 1960 by Eddie Falk, who was Mom's cousin and the son of her Aunt Effie. On it, he interviews Mom's Aunt Louise about growing up in Pittsburgh.
Well, Grandma Delp was Anna Elizabeth Beach, born in Hessen, Darmstadt, Germany. She came to this country when she was 15 years old on a sailing vessel. Each one was required to carry their own drinking water, but after a short time out, she ran out of water and was unable to get any that was decent, and from then on, she began to drink beer, which carried on for years and years. She always said that drinking water made her sick. So we children were all raised on beer, too. After Mother came to this country, Dad came from Alsace-Lorraine, and he was a fine-looking man, quite tall, a full beard and a beautiful head of hair, quite gray. Mother married him, and they lived for a time on Penn Avenue in Pittsburgh, and Father opened a barber shop, and many of the notables of Pittsburgh came there for shave and haircut because they did not shave themselves in those days. And on Penn Avenue, where the barbershop was, Dad was very thrifty and saved money, but he was very quick to give it away. He'd send for people who lived in Germany to come to this country, and he would put them in the barbershop to work, different people. The Edlis Company, which were quite noted as salespeople for barbershop equipment, were one of the ones that Dad brought from Germany. Then Mother, Jake was born about that time, and Mother and Dad were married. I forgot to mention that. It's very important. And Jake was born, the oldest one. And at that time, I forget the exact date, but that was when the Union Station on Liberty Avenue was set afire by rioters and burned to the ground. Mother was very scared, and what money she had, which was not a great deal in those days, she put in a diaper of Jake's and put in the baby buggy and put Jake on top of it and rushed down Liberty Avenue to get away from the fire and the looters and rioters that were there. She succeeded in getting away. Nobody stopped her. But after that, they moved then to Penn Avenue, where Charles was born. And Charles is still living and is 90 years old today. That was September the 11th, 1964, and is in fine health, although he's had both eyes operated on, but he's in perfect health. He's married to Cora Heber, and they have no children. Now, Mother, after Penn Avenue and that barbershop, we moved to the Albemarle Hotel, which is now the Roosevelt Hotel at the corner of 6th and Penn Avenue. It's a modern hotel today, of course, and across the street on the corner of 6th and Penn, we had another hotel called the Hamilton, but we didn't have much success with that. The Albemarle was the better one, and that is where I was born. In the meantime, Ed was born on Penn Avenue, and he died just 2 years ago in a nursing home. Charles is still living, as I said. Then Bill was born, and Bill at 16 ran away from home. He felt that he could make a name for himself in the world, and I don't know what doing, but that was the idea. He thought he was an artist. He was clever at sketching, but it never amounted to anything. And Mother was worried sick when he ran away, but we never found him, although she had hired detectives and different persons to try and locate him. But he had gone and dyed his hair blonde and got sunglasses that he wore, and he had his initials tattooed on his arm, which was WD, so he changed his name to Will Davis. And he stayed away, and then he worked as a bus boy and anything he could do to make a living and get the food. And he went to Chicago World's Fair, and a strange coincidence, Mother was there at that fair too, but they never saw each other. Well, at any rate, Dad died on Diamond Street. We had a place of business there near where, let's see, that's Diamond and Smithfield Street. We had a sort of a warehouse there, and we sold bar fixtures and pool tables. And Dad was getting up in years, I imagine. I don't know exactly how old he was at the time, but he always made the boys work when they came from school. And there was five boys at this time. And when they came from school, they would almost have to load and unload chairs. We had what you called a rental of chairs, and they were imported Vienna chairs that wouldn't break. They could throw them on the floor, and they would never break. So we'd rent wagon loads of those for different musical concerts and so forth. And it was the boys' job to put them on the truck and take the team of horses and deliver them, then go again and bring them back after the performance of whatever it happened to be. Now, at this time, my dad, who was a very, very stern man, I don't remember it, but I know from what mother has told me that he was very strict with the boys. Of course, there was no juvenile delinquency in those days. Kids worked as soon as they were able to, and it was not compulsory education either, so the boys all worked. And many a time, Dad would beat them with a billiard cue, and Mother was so frightened that he would hurt one of them badly, that she would step between the two of them, and often she got a good licking too. So anyway, after we were on Diamond Street there, Dad was working at night, bringing a bunch of stuff into the warehouse, and we had an open elevator shaft. It wasn't a passenger elevator, it was a freight elevator, and he reached out to take a hold of the cable to pull the elevator up to street level and fell down the shaft and was killed. I can recall that quite plainly, as I was a child at that time, and they brought him home to our house on where we lived on 6th Avenue now at this time, and they brought him in a patrol wagon, and when the patrol wagon came to our house, all the kids came running, wondering what had happened, and here it was my father, and he was dead. Well, that frightened me quite a bit, because we had never seen a death or had one in the family, but that's what happened there, and we lived then at 6th Avenue at the corner of 6th and what they called Strawberry Alley. Well, it's now, I think, a street. I can't recall the name of it, but it's across from the William Penn Hotel at this time. We had quite a large yard that ran the full length of that alley, and my brother Charles raised chickens there. And we had a very nice home. It was a big stone and brick house, and Mother rented the first floor to doctors, and there was Dr. Byers and Dr. Tucker and another one, I can't recall his name. They shared that first floor, what we would call a parlor, for their offices. And in the backyard, they also had a place that they filled prescriptions, and they did their own, like a drugstore, a pharmacist, and these men would work back there filling the prescriptions for their patients, and Charles had the chickens. Well, from 6th Avenue, Effie was quite a baby then, and she was so cute, she was so tiny, and people would see her on the street, and they'd say, "Look at that little rascal, she's so cute." And she was blonde and very cute. Of course, I was the older one, and I could hear these things, but Effie was the one that attracted attention. When we moved then from 6th Avenue to Wiley Avenue, 812 Wiley Avenue, at the corner of State Alley, and there our house was quite well known, because we were in the store fixture business at that time and had a lot of extra marble that they used for different things, and it was leftover pieces, and Mother had them put the whole front stairs as you went up to the house, which was about five steps, done with white marble, and everybody would say the house with the marble steps, that's where Delph lives. Well, at this time my dad was dead, of course, and as I said before, Dad never saved any money. He always was giving it away and never got a cent back. From his death on, Mother began to accumulate a little money, and she was very thifty. She took in roomers and boarders. She would never take a woman. She always had men, and men of high character, and they always liked to come to our house, and she gave them very good meals, three meals a day, breakfast, dinner, and supper. And we kids lived there, of course, and went to school down a little alley near where the arena is now. And they called it Kitty's Alley because Kitty, it was a woman who had a little candy store there. And we went to the Grant School, which was on Grant Street, near the church there, the Lutheran Church. And the Lutheran Church is where we went to. Now let me think. I'm trying to recall what happened next. We had a team of gray horses. Nobody had automobiles in those days. They were unheard of. And we had a team of gray horses in what they called a surrey. And every Sunday, Jake would have the job of getting the horses and hitch them up and take the surrey and take us for a drive through Shenley Park. And that was quite an event because from Wiley Avenue to Shenley Park was a good long drive in those days. And we had streetcars that were called trolley cars because they were run by a trolley overhead. And some of them were what they called summer cars, open cars, and some were closed. But the summer cars, you could stand on a running board if the car was crowded. And we loved those because Mother used to have a party every summer for her friends, and they all contributed food and so forth, that she didn't stand the whole expense, but they had what they call a trolley party. And these parties were done with a streetcar was rented, and then you had it for the whole evening. They would take you wherever you wanted to go, and you had all colored lights, electric lights all around it, and would holler and laugh and have a lot of fun. But we always ended up at the same place. My aunt down in Bellevue had a large piece of ground and a home. We'd end up there every time and have a big supper there. And Mother always had a regular old wicker clothes basket. She'd put a white tablecloth in and fill it with fried chicken and bread and potato salad and wieners and all sorts of good things to eat. And then a small keg of beer, which they enjoyed very much. And then when it was over, the eating and the fun, why, we would take each one home to their house, wherever they lived. Just tell the motorman where you wanted to go, and he would get out and switch the tracks and take you wherever you wanted to go. Now, in the winter time, Mother also had sleigh rides, and this was a wagon with a flatbed and runners on it, and they would take these heavy jugs that you got vinegar and stuff in, and we'd fill it with boiling hot water, and then fill the wagon with straw on the bottom. And we'd take this and go for a drive wherever we wanted to, and these were sleigh rides. And then we'd end up over in what's called South Hills now, at a place called White Hall. It was a restaurant, and they would serve you a hot meal there, and that was paid for by each one individually. So that was that part of Mother's life, and my own. I remember a good bit of this, because I'm 76 now. I was born in 1888. July the 25th. Effie, in the meantime, Mother bought another piece of property. She would buy with a down payment, and the balance she would pay as she earned it, making a living by serving meals and so forth. And she'd go to market early in the morning, and she had what they called a little station wagon with one horse, and she had a man to drive it for her. And we would go down, many days I've gone down with her at 6 o'clock in the morning when the farmers would come in, and we would get the chickens and their meat, eggs and butter and such stuff from them. And they knew her because she bought good food, and she bought in quantity because she had the roomers and boarders. And she had very fine men, as I said before. There was two boys called the Ritchie brothers. George was a fine football player, and his brother, Frank, worked for Carnegie Steel. He was an architect. And then she had a man named Hannich. He was a real estate man. And all these men, even after they married and left, they would always come back to see Mother because they felt so at home with her, and she was always so good to them. And many times she had euchre parties, and there was a crowd from Butler Street called, they had a saloon out there, their name was Nosser, and they used to come to the card parties that Mother would have, and euchre was the game that she played all the time. After we moved on Wiley Avenue, we lived next door to a wholesale liquor man. His name was Borowski, and they were a very fine Jewish family. They had no children, but they were very good and very kind and thoughtful, and Mother enjoyed them very much. Mrs. Borowski died a number of years ago, and he did too. But she had a lot of humor that Mother enjoyed, and she had a great habit of borrowing things from Mother because Mother liked nice things, and she had always cut flowers on our dining room table. No matter if it was only goldenrod, she would have flowers on the table. And Mrs. Borowski, if she had company, would come over and say, "Can I borrow your flowers? I'm going to have a dinner." And Mother would lend her the flowers for her dinner. Well, this is the part of the life that I recall most clearly because at that time I was old enough to remember. And we had on Wiley Avenue where we lived, Jenny Martin lived near us. Her mother had a little dry goods store where they made wrappers for women. And I guess nobody knows what a wrapper is this day, but they were made of calico, and you went in and gave your size, and the Martin family would make it to order for you. They were rather inexpensive, and you wore those to work in. Well, Mrs. Martin, she was the father of Dick Martin, who became judge in the court here. And Jenny was a very bright girl, and she became a teacher later on. And Nell Martin, she was a teacher, and Annie, she made hats. Now, across the street from them was a little dry goods store that Clockworthy's had, and there was a boy and a girl there, Bess and their brother, I've forgotten his name, but they lived there for quite a while, and they'd come to our house all the time. Well, in these days, the people didn't have indoor bathrooms, and they didn't have indoor toilets. You had an outside toilet and an outside. You used a wash tub to get your bath in Saturday night. So my mother said she got so tired of that, that she wanted a bathroom put in the house, and that was the first one we had ever had in our house. And every one of the girls and boys in the neighborhood would come and ask Mother, could they take a bath in our bathtub? And we had a regular routine there of everyone coming to take a bath. Incidentally, I have forgotten to mention that we had the first roller skating rink in Pittsburgh, which was at the corner of the alley opposite Joseph Horn's today on Penn Avenue. We also had the first Turkish baths, which were right where Mellon's Bank is today at 5th and Smithfield Street. And Richard Mellon, the elder, Dick Mellon's father today, came there for a Turkish bath every week, and also a shave and haircut. And Mother always took care of him, so she got to know the Mellon family very well. Of course, these people are all dead now, but Mother has told me these things many, many times. Now, as far as the rest of the family is concerned, Mother lived to be 80 years old. She had a leg amputated to the hip when she was 75 due to diabetes. We never knew that she had this disease until her foot, her big toe turned sort of black and blue, and I presume she had bruised it. So I called the doctor, and he discovered she had diabetes and advised that the leg be amputated to the hip. He says, if we take off the toe, then we'll have to take off the foot. And he says, it'll just be a piecemeal job. So Dr. Landon operated at West Penn Hospital and removed the leg to the hip. And after that, she was in a wheelchair for the balance of her life. She lived 5 years after this, but was in pretty good health all the time. And we were up there for her birthday, at her 80th birthday. All of us were there, the whole family. And she wanted us all there for her party, and we always had big parties for Mother's birthday. Effie and I would prepare everything, and we would decorate, and we would do all the things we could think of to make her happy. So she had this party, and after the party, she said, "Now I want to go to each one's house and see their yard and their flowers and so forth." Her birthday was in September. And the boys took her in the car, they carried her out and put her in the car, and they took her to each one's house, and then brought her back to her own home. And I was living in an apartment at that time on the third floor, and she said, "Well, it's too hard to take me up there." She didn't come up to my place, especially because I had no yard. But she did go to Effie's and Charles, and Ed wasn't married, and Frank was married, and she went to each one, and then we took her home. And Will and I was married to William W. Merkel at this time, and we lived just about one square from where Mother was. And we had told her good night, we were all leaving, and I had gone down ahead, and I was walking a little faster than Will. When I came to the apartment, I said, "Our telephone's ringing." And Will says, "Now don't go running up there." She said, "There's nothing here that's that important." And I said, "Well, I don't know. I think somebody's trying to get us." And I ran up the steps. And when I got up there, the phone was ringing violently, and I grabbed the phone, and it was Frank. He was still at the house, evidently had not left as soon as I did. And he said, "Louise, come back right away. Something's happened to Mom." Frank called me back, and Mother was dead. She'd had a heart attack, and the nurse took her to the bathroom. So that was a great loss to us, and we all felt badly about it. But after all, this is one of the things you can expect, especially when you're 80 years of age. Well, after this, there were other things that had happened that I sort of forgot to mention. Frank was a great lover of dogs, and he always had some kind of a dog. He had a white pit bulldog, and he was a vicious dog and would fight at the sight of another dog. And Frank used to always have him on a leash, and he would go for any dog that he'd see or any person, and his name was Major. Well, after that, when we lived on 6th Avenue, which was many years before that, we had a big dog called Rollo. It was a English Mastiff, and so huge, almost like a pony, and we could ride it. And this dog would cause more trouble than anyone we'd ever had. We had a huge collar on him with our name and address and where to call in case he wandered away, which was not likely. That dog liked his home too well, but everybody that would see him would grab him and bring him back to the house and want a reward. "Mrs. Delp, we brought your dog back." Well, this happened so many times that it got to be sort of a joke, more or less. And one time he was brought back from Detroit, and a friend of ours who happened to know that was with the railroad and saw this dog in the freight car, and he looked at it and he thought, "That looks like Delp's dog." So he went over and looked at the collar, and sure enough, there was the name and address and everything, and he inquired then who was shipping the dog, and the man was on the train. So this man that we knew very well, Charlie Hall, went up to this gentleman and he said, "Is this your dog?" And he said, "Yes." And they said, "Well, it happens to have a different name than yours." And he said, "Well, I'm going to take it back to these people, and I want to get a reward for it." So Charlie Hall said to him, "Well, you don't need to take it back. That dog knows his way home." And he said, "They have given so many rewards, I think you're wasting your time." But he did come back, and Mother did give him a reward. And once again, we had Rollo on our hands. So that was the story of the dog. Now, automobiles in these days were just coming into being, you might say. And our first car was a Rambler. I think they have Ramblers out today, but I'm not sure. But these were the oddest looking things as compared to today. And no car had a top. They were all open cars and quite high when you were sitting in them. And they had huge brass lamps that had oil burners. And you had to light these at night, the wicks. And we would go out in these cars in the daytime, go over to Schenley Park or to Highland Park for a ride on a Sunday. And we always had to carry about 5 or 6 extra inner tubes, because you wouldn't go very far before you had a puncture or a leak or something of that type would happen. So we always had to stop and change tires. And this was quite a thing, because you had to jack them up, and then we had to patch them, and which we did with the cement and the glue, and they'd go quite a little ways, and then the first thing you know, that patch would wear off because of the heat. And then we'd have another car, and we got after the Rambler, I think it was a National, and then we had finally got a Buick, and this was the first car, I think, that we had with a top, and the top then was not permanent as they are today. It was a canvas or some sort of rubberized material that folded up, and when you pull it up and fasten it down in the front so it would keep it from flying away, then you had to put extra curtains on the sides, and these curtains were all done with the little buttons that you had to press in, and they were all different shapes. And what a time we would have if it would start to rain and you had to put these curtains on. You could never find the right one for the right place. But we did it anyway, and that was the way we had cars in those days. Well, when the first car come out with a top on, Mother said, "That's what I want. I want a car that has a top on it. It's just raining and getting wet. That's no fun." So we got our first car with a top, and it had a lot of brass trimmings on too, like the other cars. And it was a question for the boys always to shine this brass. At this time, we lived on Center Avenue, 5739, and we had a garage in the back of the house down in an alley, and we'd come down the alley and put the car in the garage, and the boys had dug a pit there so that they could get down under the car and work on the under part of it. You couldn't raise your car like they do today, so they always had me down in the hole too to see what was the matter. And of course, I didn't understand it too much, but being the only girl and the five boys, they always hollered, "Come on, Lil, get down here in the pit and see what we're doing." So we lived in a beautiful house, is that it, on Center Avenue. It was built by Murphy and Diebold. They built two identical houses, and we understood that the two wives didn't get along very well. So the Murphys offered their house for sale, and Mother decided to buy it. Well, Effie and I, they took us out one evening to see the house, and we went by streetcar. We thought it was quite a ways out. But after we got in the house, we couldn't find our way around. It had a huge reception hall, and what they called a front parlor and a back parlor, a great big dining room, and a butler's pantry, and a great big kitchen, and then a den all on the first floor, and the reception hall, all of woodwork that was beautiful, and a burl of walnut. It was just out of this world, beautifully carved, and the decorations were all hand-painted, the walls and ceilings and such. We had never seen a home like this. And on the second floor was Mother's bedroom in the front, which had what they call today a picture window. Huge, big window right at the front. And then there was a second bedroom next to hers. I had the next bedroom to hers. Then Effie had a bedroom across the hall, and Jake had a bedroom in the back, and Bill had a bedroom. There were also two baths on that floor. The third floor was five rooms, and one was completely done in cedar, so that it was for like a cedar closet, but the whole room was made of cedar. So it was very different and very lovely, and we appreciated it so much. It was a gorgeous home. But we had to take a streetcar to go to school then, because I was going to Fifth Avenue High School at that time, and it was too far to walk. And Effie was going to Liberty School, which was a walkable distance. Of course, she was younger than I. Well, I wanted to talk to you about the Bill got involved with a friend, a woman. She was called Madame Zeno, and at that time, Shenley Park was always wanting some novelty to attract attention to the park and so forth, and they paid her to make balloon ascensions. Now, these were done in a very different way than they are today. Will would go out there, and they had a pit dug, and they would put wood in and start a fire. Now, this balloon was made of some sort of fireproof material and had a netting on the outside of it. It was quite large. And they'd get people, volunteers, and they're standing around watching the goings-on to take a hold of it and hold it down to the ground. And as they did that, Bill would put firewood into this pit, which would create heat, and it would eventually fill the balloon until it was left up and the handholds all around the balloon. And each time Will would call, they'd let go of that one and take the next one until it was completely filled. And this Madame Zeno always appeared in tights, and she would come out and make a bow to the people and so forth. And she had a trapeze strung from this balloon, and she'd sit on that. And when Bill would give the signal, the people would all let go, and up she would go, way up into the air. And she would do all sort of fancy stunts on the trapeze while she was floating around. Well, this, of course, often happened that it was nothing serious would happen. When the smoke finally left her, the heat left the balloon, she would just calmly come down to ground. But sometimes she lived on the roof of a house or in a tree, and several times she had bones broken, so she had to be in the hospital. She was a very nice-looking person, and the men especially enjoyed seeing her doing these stunts on the trapeze. Bill did this on Sundays, and of course he was always paid extra for this. Madame Zeno almost paid him for it, and he always took Effie and I along to watch. and we enjoyed it so much, and everybody thought we were her children. We were no relation at all. We just went for the fun of it, but Bill enjoyed doing it. And she eventually left Pittsburgh. The fad was wearing out. There were more novelties coming into the Pittsburgh area, and she finally left and went to California. And until a short time ago, she lived out there. She lived to be quite old, and she used to write to me, but after she passed on, why, there was no more balloons, of course, and today that would be just small talk, you might say. Well, when we lived on Center Avenue, we had another experience, and talking about balloons, we had a friend, her name was Mrs. Van Boris, and she had a gentleman friend who was well up in years, but I think he was one of the first Pittsburgh balloonists that I ever heard of. At the corner of Baum and Center Avenue, there was a great big vacant lot owned by the Baum family, and he asked if he could use that to build a balloon, an airplane rather. And he went in there, and he did build an airplane. Now, I don't know how he had the idea, except it was in his mind. He was a very intelligent man, and he built this balloon, and the people, or airplane rather, and the people would come there and watch it. But it looked very frail and fragile to anybody who looked at it, and nobody wanted to take a chance to go up in it. But he finally had someone try it, and it didn't go very far until it crashed. Well, Bill, I think it was this time that Bill got the notion of airplanes, too. And he bought this airplane and tried to complete it and have it in working order again. And before he died, it was still in the warehouse, our place of business, down on Fifth Avenue in Soho. It was 2219 Fifth Avenue. We had a great large building there, and in the rafters, he had this airplane hanging there. And when the business was sold out, of course, the airplane went with it, and I think it was sent to some place for an antique. But the motor he had at the garage, he had that set there. Well, then the, what else? Oh, yes. When Bill came back from his runaway trip at the age of 21, he wrote a letter when he was 21 years of age and wrote to Mother and said, if you want me to, I'll come home. I'm in Cincinnati. Mother told Charles, who was the next brother, you write and tell him. I didn't tell him to run away, and I'm not telling him to come back. She had shed so many tears and so much expense trying to find him that she was quite provoked with him. But he was back on the next train. So he came to the house in Center on Wiley Avenue. I'm getting all mixed up again. On Wiley Avenue, and he wanted Mother to put him in business as a candy manufacturer, because that is what he had learned on his trip around the United States when he had run away from home from the age of 15 till he was 21. That was 6 years. Well, he knew how to make candy all right. He made good candy, but it required a lot of special equipment, which meant great big copper kettles, and you'd stir this batter or candy. It was made with sugar, of course, and glucose, and you cook that and stir it with big wooden paddles over open fireplace that he had built in the cellar on Wiley Avenue. And then he had molds made. Well, those were trays, and they were, oh, an average of, I would say, foot and a half wide, 2 feet long, and they were filled with cornstarch. And he had carved miniature animals, birds, dogs, cats, most anything, flowers, out of a plaster Paris. And he would mount that on a board and then impress that into the cornstarch, then fill each one of these cavities with this cream candy. Then this was taken out of the cornstarch when it hardened, and there it would be tinted with the dyes of different kind, candy dyes that were edible, but they made very pretty pieces. And of course he dipped chocolates, and that was done by hand. After the creams were just made into chocolate drops or some such shape, whatever you wanted, why, he had girls that he would have them dip this candy into a big chocolate batter, and then you'd put it on a wax paper, and when it hardened, it was ready for sale. Well, he made an awful lot of this candy, and he sold it mainly to McTighe's. They were great market people in the market down on Market Street. They had a candy shop there, and Will sold them the candy, and they sold it to the public. But I think they soon got tired of him. He was always pestering them for something new, and Bill was a great guy to think about things. He was always on the go, and he had more ideas than a dog had fleas. And it was a question of bicycles, or let's take an airplane or something. And then incidentally mentioning bicycles, everyone in the family had a bicycle, and they hung on our back porch. He had put some sort of contrivance up to hang them up so that they wouldn't be on the laying on the floor all the time. And at that time, we had built, or he had designed and built what they called a tandem. Not that you ride one in back of the other, but you rode side by side. And we had this bicycle built, and he would take that on a Sunday afternoon and take somebody with him and ride around through Shenley Park or Highland Park just to attract attention. That's what he liked. Anybody that would turn and look, that was Will's hobby. So that was one of the bicycle adventures. Then the, what else? Oh, motorcycles. Oh, he got wild on motorcycles when they came out. Ed had one, and he had one, and he'd put on goggles and see how fast he could get them to go, and he put special sprockets and geared them up so high that they would go like the devil. And the faster they went, the better he liked it. And he rode from here to New York, and he would go to Atlantic City. He'd go any place just to get a ride with a motorcycle. And people would say to him, "Well, where'd you come from?" He said, "Well, I come from Pittsburgh." "My heavens, that's an awful distance." Well, in those days, it seemed like an awful distance. Of course, today with an airplane, it's nothing. But he'd do that, and he did that with even bicycles that he had to ride and pedal. He pedaled clear to Brooklyn with a bicycle that he had built, and he put this huge sprocket on so that his feet wouldn't turn so fast. And when he got there, these friends he went to visit, they said, "How on earth did you stand it, Bill? So many hills and all." And he says, "Hills? It was all downhill. I didn't see any hills." But Bill is a great kidder, and it's that the way he would talk. He'd kid the people all the time. Well, he was the one who finally took over the warehouse in Soho. We had a place of business at 4th and Liberty Street, and Mother decided that we could enlarge our place, and she bought this property at Soho at Brady Street on 5th Avenue. And this was a building that was torn down and moved piece by piece out to 5th Avenue and rebuilt by William Greaser. He was a man who built breweries in Pittsburgh and a great friend of Mother's. And he built what we called our warehouse out there. And it was a great big building, all brick, and great big show windows. But Bill enlarged and kept on increasing the business. That is, he took out cut out the pool tables so much, and he went into more store fixtures and butcher fixtures, ice boxes. We built them there. We built all sorts of store fixtures, and he did buy other stuff, and a lot of people thought we were Jewish because he had so much secondhand stuff. And he'd see a good buy, he'd buy it, of course, and he'd always sell it at a profit. And he had the first floor with coffee urns and silverware for hotels or restaurants, and he sold a good bit of his stuff on what we call time at that, selling at that time, and on a lease. You would buy the goods and make out a list of what you were buying and what it cost, and then the total, and then they'd make a down payment on it, maybe $100 or $150 if the bill was around $500 or $600, and then they'd pay so much a month until it was paid up, and then the fixtures and were completely theirs. But in doing this, he also got into a mess by selling to people out of the state, that it was West Virginia or Virginia. And these people would move by night and take all the store fixtures, and we had a hard time tracing them. We'd have to get lawyers and private detectives, and finally when you find your stuff, it wasn't half there. You could reclaim it, replevin it, but you didn't want it anymore. It was half worn out and destroyed, or they'd sold half of it. So we were always in a mess when they sold out of town like that, unless you had customers that you knew something about, that were decent people and trustworthy. but Bill was a great one to trust anybody. He just thought nobody would jip him out of anything, or he was going to beat him up. He loved to fight. He went down once. Mother sent him down when we lived on Wiley Avenue to an Italian who was not too far from us to get a watermelon. And Bill went down and brought this. She said, now be sure to plug it. And when they say plug it, they cut a little triangular piece out of it and taste it to see if it was sweet and if it was ripe. And that was the only way they knew to do in those days. So Bill had him pluck the watermelon, and he thought it was good. So he brought it up to Mother, and she looked at it. She had a way of thumping it with her finger, and she said, this is not a good watermelon. And he said, Mother, it is. He said, look at this piece. She says, I don't care. It's not ripe enough. But the seeds are not black. They should be black, not white. So she said, I'll just show you. So she cut a little deeper into the watermelon, and sure enough, she was right. Bill was wrong. So she said, take it back to him and tell him you don't want it, but you want a good, ripe watermelon. Well, they weren't cheap in those days. Then Bill took the watermelon back. Well, this Italian refused to change it for him. So Bill says, you'll give me another watermelon or I'll know the reason why. And he just picked up that big, long watermelon and smashed it right at this Italian's feet. Just all smithereens. It was just a mess. And the Italian, in the meantime, had reached for a big cheese knife. They had a great big round cheese there, and this cheese knife was like almost the size of a sword. And he grabbed this cheese knife, and he was going to cut Bill with it. And Bill grabbed him, and he was very powerful. He had great muscles and strong, and the poor fellow was so scared that Bill grabbed him and threw him up against the wall and tore his whole shirt off. And when Will came home, he had his shirt pretty well torn, too. But we had no watermelon. So Mother said, now what did you do? He says, well, that Dago's not going to get away with that as long as I'm living. He says, he's going to give me a watermelon or I'm going to kill him. And of course, he didn't kill him, and we didn't get a watermelon, but we never patronized him anymore either. And one time, Ed and Effie and Bill and myself, we had passes from most of the theaters in town, which weren't many in those days. There was one next to our hotel when we had the hotel called the Bijou, and that was a very lovely theater at those times. And we had passes for that all the time. And this particular time, Bill and Ed decided that Effie and I were allowed to go to see this show. And Mother said, well, now watch the girls and don't let anything happen to them, because we were quite young. And you had to come on the streetcar from Center Avenue downtown. So they took us down, and we saw this show, and we got out about 11 o'clock at night, and we got on the streetcar to come home, and the car was quite crowded, and I had a seat, and I think that Effie had a seat, but the boys were standing, and standing in front of me was a man who seemed to be slightly under the control of liquor. He was swaying back and forth, and he wasn't sober, I'm quite sure. So he finally leaned over and he says to me, get up there and let the guy sit down. I worked all day. He said, you don't need to sit there. Well, I was going to get up because I was frightened of him, and I knew that Bill would fight in a minute, so I thought better for me to get up and give him my seat than to have a fracas on the car. So I was just getting up when Bill said, who are you talking to? That's my sister. He says, she's not going to get up for you. And he smashed him clear through the streetcar window. And poor Ed was scared to death because he was no fighter. And I was scared, too. And they stopped the car immediately, of course, and arrested Ed, and they arrested Bill. And Effie and I got off the car and followed them down to the police station, which was on Montour Way downtown. And when we got down there, we asked if we could telephone. And the police said, have you got any money? Well, we didn't have any money. And I said, well, I think my brothers have. Well, you can't talk to them. They're under arrest. And I said, well, I can't get home. What am I going to do? He said, where do you live? We told them on Center Avenue. And this was down on around 6th Street downtown in Pittsburgh. So I said, well, can't you ask them to give us money for car fare? And they said, no, you'll have to get home the best you know how. So they wouldn't even allow us to talk to them, and we were furious, and we were scared to death because it was 12 o'clock midnight almost. So we went out, and we got on the Center Avenue car, and most of the motorman and conductors knew us because we'd lived there on Center Avenue so long. And fortunately, we got the car that one of the men knew us very well, and when he looked at us when we got on the streetcar and said, "What on earth happened to you girls? What are you doing out this late at night?" And we said that Ed and Bill had been arrested and were in jail for fighting. And he said, and I said, "We don't have any money. We can't pay any car fare." And they said, "Don't worry about it. We'll let you off at the house." Well, the car stopped right in front of our house, so we got off, and we got in the house. We rang the bell, and Mother had to come down. She was in bed. She came down and let us in, and she says, "What on earth happened now?" And they said, "Ed and Bill's in jail." Well, she said, "What happened?" So we explained to her what happened, and she said, "Well, don't worry about it." She says, "I'll have them out in a little bit." Well, it seemed they had almost enough bail to get out, but it wasn't enough for the two of them, and they wouldn't let them out on bail. So Mother called Roger Romero, who was chief of police at that time and a great friend of Mother's, and she told Roger what had happened. And he said, "Don't worry, Mrs. Delph, go on back to bed." He says, "I'll have the boys home in a minute." So he called up the police station, and the first thing you know, Bill and Ed were on the streetcar coming home. So that was another experience of the two boys and the trouble they get into. Bill was a football player, and he would go any place and play for anybody. He never was paid. He played for the Lyceum, he played for the YMCA, he played for anybody, and he had more stove fingers than anybody I ever saw. So he would take Effie and I along on these games, always to watch him play. He liked the gallery, it seems. So this particular time, he took us out of town on a train, and we went down to this little town, I forget which one it was now, and I guess I was probably 12 or 15 years old at that time, and Effie was 3 years younger. So we went with him and saw the game, and Bill was not a good loser. If he lost a game, there was always a fight. So this particular time, the other side won, and of course Bill was furious. He said they did something that wasn't legal, and he accused them of all sorts of things. So they started to throw rocks at us. And we were trying to get out of the town to get on the train. So Bill grabbed me and jumped me off the train, which was moving, and threw Effie off the train at the same time, you might say. Ed jumped on, and Bill jumped on, and the rocks were flying in every direction. Then they were running after the train trying to catch us, but we finally got out of that mess, too. So we could go on and on. These Delphs were just a different kind of breed of cats, it seems. I was just telling Yeti about an incident on Center Avenue about a burglar breaking into the house because they happened to know that Jake carried the money and so forth from the store. And they broke into a side window in the den and came up the back steps and went right to Jake's bedroom, and which was right across the hall from Bill's. Well, Jake woke up, he was sound asleep, but woke up.
This is the second part of the Delp family history as transcribed from a cassette tape made around 1960 by Eddie Falk, who was Mom's cousin and the son of her Aunt Effie. On it, he interviews Mom's Aunt Louise about growing up in Pittsburgh.
He heard a scratching noise, and he listened and didn't see anybody or anything, and so he laid down again. And this man, who was in his room, but at the foot of the bed, had scratched down so that no one could see him. And he was looking for Jake's pants because he had the money in there and the keys to the store. He was going to make a clear getaway. So when he lit another match, Jake heard it, and he hollered right away, "Bill," because Bill's a fighter, and he thought Bill would catch him and just beat the daylights out of him. Bill never even heard him. But I heard him, and I was at the front part of the house, and when Jake yelled so loud, I jumped out of bed and ran out into the hall, and hear the men run right past me down the front steps and out the front door. In the meantime, we all hollered so loud that Bill did wake up and come running down with a revolver, down the front steps and out into Center Avenue, and he was firing a gun in every direction, but not hitting anything, just firing the gun. But the man got away, but he didn't get any money, fortunately. But we were frightened after that. That was one of the incidents that happened. And what was the other one, Eddie? Oh, down at the 4th Avenue. We'd had a burglary down there. We had always handled pool tables and had this very fine imported Belgian billiard cloth. I don't think they use it today. It's very expensive. It was used for the pool tables, and it came in bolts and was shipped from Belgium. And we had a great big chest upstairs in the store that we kept all this cloth in with mothballs so that no mold would get into it. It was expensive. And Mr. Roth used to sell this to us. And every time he came to Pittsburgh, he would come out of the house to see us. And he always brought another beautiful broadcloth to make a dress. Black broadcloth was just as gorgeous as could be. You don't find cloth like that today. And he would usually bring a piece of silk for Effie and one for me for a dress. But anyway, after the man broke in down at the Fourth of Liberty and stole some of this figured cloth, Bill decided that it was somebody who knew the store pretty well, or he would never have known all that cloth was there. So he says, "I'll catch him. I'll go down there and I'll stay all night. I'll just sit there and watch for him." So he did. He went down, and where the cloth was on that floor, he got a billiard chair. They're a little different than the average chair. They're higher and have a very comfortable seat. And he had a gun that he laid, not a revolver, but a gun laid across his lap. And he was sitting there all night watching for this man to break in again. And he sat there for about four nights, and nobody ever showed up. I think whoever it was, of course, knew the place and the time that anybody would be there or not be there. And when they had heard that Bill was sitting there all night, going to get him, why, he never came back, so there was no cloth stolen after that. But he did get away with quite a bit of cloth the first time. Okay, now, I forgot to mention, at first, we had our place of business at the corner of the 6th Street Bridge, that is the 6th Street Bridge now, on Federal Street, and this was the S. Delp Sutton's, and we sold bar fixtures and pool tables there. We had taken a lease on quite a section there, and we didn't own the property outright, but we did have a lease on all this ground. Next to it was a small fruit stand run by an Italian, and he had fresh fruits, which were out on the street like, and he always had chocolate drops. They were very popular in those days. And every Saturday night when Mother would come home from the store, she'd go over there and see that the business was carried on properly. She'd bring home about 5 pounds of chocolate drops, and she always gave them to Effie. And Effie was quite small at that time, and she'd make each one of us beg for a chocolate drop, and we'd get one at a time. That's the way she handed them out. Well, anyway, from the candy store, next to that was what we call Delp and Bell Furniture Company. Now that was furniture that was for home use. And John Bell was the organist at a church, and Mother thought he was a very fine man. And he had a daughter named Martha, and his wife was dead. They lived on the north side. Well, after that came what they call the World's Museum. It is nothing like it in Pittsburgh or anywhere today that I know of. The place looked like a theater. You bought a ticket and you went in. And there was a great big open hall, and in this hall was all sorts of freaks, like you see in the circus. The bearded lady, the fat lady, and the midgets, and the tricksters, then as the magicians and so forth. And you'd walk around for probably an hour seeing all these different people perform. And then the bell would ring, and they'd open the theater doors, and you'd go in and take a seat. And you had this wonderful show, either Uncle Tom's Cabin, or, there was Hamlin's Superba, and there was, Betty's she's laughing at me. There was different shows, I can't remember. Uncle Tom's Cabin was one of the most popular ones, though. The sea lions are crossing the ice, and it was very exciting, and we kids just loved it. And we'd go there every time because we could get in for nothing and spend half a day there, you might say, just seeing this wonderful theater. Well, anyway, it was quite some time after this. We had no insurance there because these were all frame buildings, and Mother had taken a chance on it. Nothing could happen. But we were living on Wally Avenue at that time, and we heard the fire engines, and they kept coming and making such a terrific noise. And I said, "That must be an awfully big fire." And Mother says, "It must be." She said, "Listen, there's so many engines going." So we all ran and trying to get near where the fire was. And I landed down on 9th Street in a sort of an office building there. Somebody lifted me up and put me on the windowsill because I was too small to get up there. And I could see the fire clear across the bridge. And I was so proud. I said, that's our place burning down. I was too dumb to know what it meant to my poor mother because we had no insurance at all. And when we came home, Mother said, now what'll we do? She didn't know what on earth we were going to do to try and make a living. So she still had her roomers and boarders, and she started over again from scratch. And finally, was able to accumulate enough money to buy another piece of property. Mother believed in property. She didn't believe in stocks and bonds. She said, stocks and bonds, you got nothing but a piece of paper, but property, you can put your hand on it. So she finally bought 1412 Wiley Avenue. And this she rented to a colored man. His name was Walker Branch and his wife. And they had a very nice saloon there. They sold beer and liquor and so forth. And they were so nice to Mother. They were very kind and thoughtful of her because she had been kind enough to rent it to them because they were colored. And Mother said, I don't care if they're colored or not as long as they're honest. And they were a very fine pair. And they would always come on Mother's birthday and make a big to-do about it. That is, Mrs. Walker would come and fry chickens, and we'd have potato salad, and we'd have all our friends invited, and Effie and I put decorations all around the house. And we had Halloween parties, and all on Center Avenue, we had a Halloween party once, and Mother would never dress up. And I asked her, Mother, you're going to dress up this time. And she said, listen, everybody knows me. They know me just by my voice. I said, you're not going to talk. She said, what are you going to make me? And I said, I'm going to make you a monk, a Friar Tuck. And I got brown cloth and made her a great big, like a Mother Hubbard thing, loose and flowing sleeves. And I put a rope around her waist, and I got her a false face, and I got a pair of one of the boys' shoes and put on her, and I sat her in a big easy chair and said, now you just sit here and don't say anything. And I had got her a big rosary bead and hang down her side, and there she sat. And everybody that would come in would come over and talk to her, and she'd just shake her head. And she had a very peculiar false face and had eyelashes that had a string attached, and you could make them blink. And she would blink these eyes at the people, you know, and they'd come and talk to her. But she wouldn't open her mouth. She'd just blink. Well, nobody guessed all evening who she was. And Effie and I had done up the house till it was just out of this world. I don't think an interior decorator could have done better because the house, it gave itself to decoration, the reception hall mainly. We had a great big fireplace there, and we had put artificial logs and a red electric light bulb underneath to make it look as though it was burning, and we had a fan with paper flowing and make it look like flames. And then we had taken each of the newel posts that led up the stairway and decorated them. One was a skeleton and one was a scarecrow. We had taken straw and we had got false faces, and we took the boys' long underwear and stuffed it with paper and had all decorations around, and the newspaper people came out and took pictures of the house. They had heard about it, and they asked Mother if they could come and take pictures. So it was all in the Sunday paper about the party at Delp's. Also, the Mother had a front porch there, which was quite large, and she was so fond of plants. And she had huge rubber plants and ferns and gorgeous big jardiniers, and they were just out of this world. And she always had a red velvet carpet down the stairway there. And they came out and took a picture of that and called it the conservatory house. I had that picture for some time, but I think it's been mislaid, and I don't know what became of it. But there was always something that was different that the Delps were doing. I was just telling the children about the prices of things in those days. You got a loaf of bread for a nickel, and you got a quart of milk for a nickel. But you had to go to the store to get it. They didn't deliver anything for you. And we had a store near us where they had this milk in a great big ice box. It was about the size of a good-sized desk, and it had sliding doors on the top of it. Two old ladies ran this little store, and you would go there with your can and tell them what you wanted, a quart or a gallon of milk. And they would slide the doors open, and with a long-handled dipper, they would dip down into this can and get you either enough to fill your quart can or two quarts, it'd be 5 or 10 cents, and you carried that home. And the same way, we used to get a great big dill pickle or sour pickle, maybe 6 inches long for a penny. And the same with penny candies in those days. You'd get a big, long strip of licorice with buttons on it. They were all different colors. And you'd eat that, or you could get 6 licorice sticks for a cent, And you can get, you can get a nice piece of chocolate for a penny. You would never have had more than a penny to spend. If somebody would ask you to go to the store, mother always said, go for the neighbors whenever they ask you. And if you got a penny for going, you were very lucky and you were very pleased. But a penny today wouldn't mean anything. It's like the doctors making house calls. They just don't do it today, as Jackie Gleason said. But that was part of the age and then the time. And the same way I was telling them, the best pair of shoes you could possibly buy would be $3.50. And usually our school shoes run about $1. And they was very close. A house and a store were practically next door to each other. It isn't like it is today that things are restricted in building codes and so forth. We had a wholesale liquor house next to us on Wiley Avenue. And next to that was a dry goods store. And then next to that was a shoe repair shop. And then maybe there'd be a home. It was never like it is today. And across the street from us was Dr. Snively and his family. And it just went on that way from one place to another. You could get anything you wanted on the street where you lived. You didn't have to go to downtown or anything. But Mother's told me about Market Street. She said Joseph Horn started there, and they had what they called a morning store, which handled nothing. Mother's told me about Joseph Horn's. When they started, they had a store on Market Street, a very small store. It was what was called a morning store. In those days, when someone had a death in the family, the wife always wore black for maybe 6 months or more, and she'd have a long veil hanging down her back, which was black with crepe all around it, and black dress, black shoes, everything black, and the long veil over her face. That veil she could see through and could be lifted up very easily. But that was almost, but you had to do it. It was custom and everybody expected you to do it. Today they don't do that. Now, another thing, Henry Kaufman at that time, which was many years ago, Mother told me that he used to come around with a pack on his back with notions of all sorts. He'd have thread and thimbles and tape measures and yard goods and so forth, and he'd always come and ask you to buy something. And she said, I always bought a paper of pins from him to help him out. And he was very fond of Mother, and finally when they did get to their big store, Mother was still living, and I can remember stopping there many times with our, what we call our little station wagon. That was a horse-drawn vehicle. And Mother had gone down to the farmer's market on Market Street and bought a bushel of plums and baskets of grapes and all this fruit and stuff, and she'd have it in the station wagon when we'd stop. He'd always come out of the store and come out the front door and come out and say, what have you got this morning, Mrs. Delp? And he'd fill his pockets with plums and stuff. Always tell me about it because I was just a kid, and he'd say, your mother was always good to me. She always helped me out. So he said, now I'm going to help her out. I'm going to eat her fruit. So he was always kidding and teasing her about it. And then, of course, we remember when there was a store on Fifth Avenue. It's about where Lane Bryant's is now. It was called Danzinger's. And they had a dry goods store there. And they're out of business for many years. And across the street from that, where the theater is now, and that was called the Fifth Avenue Theater. And it had the first motion pictures in Pittsburgh. And Mother had seen one, and she was so thrilled about it. But it was what they call a Nickelodeon. You paid 5 cents to get in and see it. But she was so thrilled with this picture. It was silent, and it showed two children having a pillow fight. And as they fought, the pillows burst open, and the feathers flew in all directions. Well, she thought this was so marvelous that she demanded Charles take Effie and I down to see this picture. So we went to see it too, and that was the first motion picture I'd ever seen, and that's where it was. And of course, we never paid more than a nickel to see a picture. Of course, they were silent, but just the fact that there were motion pictures is just out of this world, and there were usually comedies like these Three Stooges of today, and just ridiculous. And some of those boys that are men now, they were boys in that time, like Jackie Cooper and those, all grown up men now. they were acting in those pictures. And another person that I recall, and it was quite a scandal at the time, was Evelyn Nesbitt Law. She went to dancing school with my sister and myself on 4th Avenue, where Robert Thelma had his dancing academy, he and his sister Margaret, and we're all dancing together there. And she was very graceful and very pretty girl, but she got mixed up with Thaw somewhere or other, and her mother and she used to come to our house quite often and visit us. We knew them very well, and we couldn't believe the scandal about her. I still don't believe that this is all it's cracked up to be, but I can't vouch for it because I don't know. She left Pittsburgh, and I don't know just exactly what did happen. But at the same time, Margaret Thelma, as I said, was teaching dancing, and I think she was the... I was probably one of the first persons to do a cakewalk in Pittsburgh. She taught me that. And I did it over in the north side in a big hall called Cyclorama. And my mother had gotten me a beautiful red satin dress and a high silk hat. And she taught me this cakewalk. And I won the cake, and I've won many cakes since for doing cakewalks. And I got a prize at the Pittsburgh Field Club for a costume mimicking Mae West. And that was quite an outfit. I had a beautiful black velvet hat that I had, mother had had made for me with a big white willow plume on it. I had a rhinestone front on a gorgeous pink chiffon dress that I'd had for evening wear. And all the rhinestones I could lay my hands on, I put on and went out to the field club with Mr. Merkel and won the prize out there for Mae West. And I had a blonde wig too, and that made me very feminine. So we had a lot of fun doing different things like that. And Ed, every one of them has had a narrow escape in their life. Ed was almost drowned down at the 6th Street Bridge. He fell between two barges. They had been cautioned not to go near the river. And he went down and was jumping from one barge to another, and he fell between two of them, and two men saw him go down, or he would have never been here today. They jumped in and saved his life. And Frank, he fell through the skylights when we had the hotel, and he was badly cut all in a number of places. He still had the scars today. And while I was there, that's where I was born, and I was just learning to crawl, and mother had a nursemaid for me because she was too busy to watch me all the time. And this girl was cleaning the mantelpiece at that time in the room that we lived in, and she had put everything on the floor for me to play with. And incidentally, I happened to play with a bottle of carbolic acid, which I drank, and would have been dead had it been for the doctor who was in the hotel at the time, and he stayed with me all night and all day. And mother tells me my mouth was one huge blister, and they kept putting, wrapping me in blankets and putting hot flat irons around me. But at any rate, I lived to tell the tale, which was unusual, and they kept feeding me castor oil when I was able to take anything into my stomach. And that was the other thing I had, was oil. So when Charles then, he was playing one day, and he was, in those days, the people who had fruit stands on the streets, and they'd have a canvas that would come from the building out to the sidewalk, to the curb, and then there were iron posts there, and that canvas protected their produce. Well, Charles was playing like a ring around the rosy on one of these poles and swinging himself, and he fell out into the street by accident, and a team of horses came along. It stepped on him and broke his jaw, and some people brought him home, and when Dad saw him, he gave him a good licking for getting hurt. That's the way the Germans raised their children. And Effie and I, Mother wanted us to learn to swim. And at that time, there was a natatorium, as they called it, down in Duquesne Way, right near the 6th Street Bridge. And she sent us down there to take lessons. Well, we had these ridiculous bathing suits that they wore in those days, stockings and slippers and pantaloons, and they were covered from head to foot. So we were taking lessons, and this man was teaching us. We went there on a certain day, and he thought we'd been there long enough to learn. And I was frightened to death because the pool was graduated from about 3 feet to 6 feet deep. And I was walking along the outer edge of it one day, and he came up and back at me and threw me in the 6 foot depth and thought I would swim out. Well, I pretty near drowned. He had to jump in and save me. He had to get in with his clothes too. But I would have drowned if he hadn't done that. But I never went near the water after that. I was scared to death. And then instead of making a swimmer out of me, I made a coward. And then Effie wouldn't go either because I wouldn't go. So we never learned to swim. And the boys never swam either. But Charles, he was different than the rest of us. Mother always thought he was delicate. And he's the one that's 90 years old now. She wouldn't let him lift anything heavy, and don't let Charlie do this, and don't let Charlie do that, because he's delicate, he's not strong. And she was always protecting Charlie. And as a result of that, I don't know, but he plays piano very well. The rest of us had music lessons, but we never amounted to anything. But my father was a wonderful musician. He had a band, he had his barbershop during the day, and at night he had a dance band, is what he called it. And he could play almost any instrument, and he had these men, and they would go to different places and play for dances until 12 o'clock at night, and then they would go home. And Mother tells me that she used to make a good bit of my dad's clothes. She made his trousers, she'd buy the cloth and make trousers for him, and she said she used to make him fancy vests. And everybody would say, Delp, where'd you get that vest? His name was really spelled D-O-L-P and pronounced Dolp. When he came to this country, there was an umlaut over the O, but the people began to call him Delp, and he thought rather than have it so confused, he changed it to D-E-L-P and pronounced it Delp after that. And of course, Mother's name was Anna Beach, and she had quite a few brothers. I think there's 7 brothers. I can't recall them all. Frank would know them, but I don't. But one was called Peter John, one was called John Peter, and that was ridiculous for one family. But she had just one sister, and her mother stayed in Germany and never came to this country. And before she died, she went blind, Mother's mother. It was my great-grandmother. And I never saw her. She stayed in Germany. But I went to Europe, but when I went over, they were all gone. The relatives were all out of Europe, so I never saw anybody. But Charles, he could tell you more of this than I can, but I don't know how good his memory is anymore. I've talked to him, but with age, you forget things. And just as I'm forgetting and have to go back every once in a while. This is just for the children's benefit, so they know where they came from. we had a place in Pittsburgh. It was down on the wharf at Duquesne Way, and there was 2 big buildings there. One was a huge building, and they called it Exposition. And the school children were given a pass once a year to go there on a certain day. We went free to get into the building, but if you went other times, then you had to pay 25 or 50 cents, I forget the amount. But when you got in there, the main building had all the different stores, Rosenbaum's, Horn's, Kaufman's, every store had a display, and the jewelry stores and such places, candy stores. Every store had a beautiful display, and you just walk around and look for hours. It was so interesting and so fascinating. And then outdoors, they had a big Ferris wheel, and they had a roller coaster, and they had all sorts of amusements. And then they had the other building, which was called Machinery Hall. And that was so noisy, you couldn't hear yourself think, because they had all kinds of big apparatus and machinery going in there. And they had one place where they brought apples, and they would crush them and make apple cider, and they would sell it to you 5 cents a glass. And we all rushed there to get cider. We loved that so much. It was such a good drink, and I don't think it was very clean, but it was good. I don't think they took much care of the apples. But just to see those big machines working and the men oiling them and greasing them and what they made, steel, and it was so noisy, you couldn't talk in there. And that was something that we all looked forward to go to the exposition. And it's a shame they don't have it today, really, because that was something that the kids loved so much. The amusements, and then the old Luna Park on Craig Street and Bomb Boulevard, that would be lit up at night with all colored lights, and they had all sorts of amusements in there. They Ferris wheels, the roller coasters, and the merry-go-rounds, and the swings, and the different stands. They would have sideshows that you could pay extra to go into, and that was a very fascinating thing. Of course, that's gone, and the old Calhoun Park that used to be out on the I think it's over in the north, the South Hills side of the country. It used to be there, Calhoun Park, Kennywood Park. Kennywood's still in existence today, but quite different from what it used to be. And that would go to a picnic, we'd go there too for amusements. But in my school day, when we went to the Grant School, which was on the Grant Street, we always had a boat ride. We would get on a steamboat down at the corner of Duquesne Way and the 6th Street Bridge, and we'd ride down to McKees Rocks, which was a big deal. And there we'd get off the boat and we'd have a picnic basket for food. We'd eat that, and then we'd play baseball or different games that the kids would make a circle and tag each other, and then they'd run, and it was nothing much, but that was the only amusement there was. There was no kind of amusement that you could pay for or anything. That was the gist of the day. But then get on the boat and come back again, that was quite a deal. And he was just telling me, I remembered when they cut Grant's Hill down, they call it Grant's Hill, it's Fifth Avenue, and it came up from Smithfield Street up to Wiley Avenue, you might say, and it was a terrific grade. You just couldn't hardly walk up there. You can't believe how steep that was. And they decided they were going to cut it down. So they got the bulldozers in there, and they whacked away, and they cut it down, and it was just marvelous, but they didn't cut enough. So after they had another building built, I think it was the Frick Building at that time, on the right-hand side going up, and they decided that they hadn't cut enough down, so they proceeded to start and cut more, and they took as much off again as they had taken the first time. And today it's still quite a grade, but oh, it was terrific if you'd seen it in those days. And at that time, they didn't have the equipment to do it that they have today. Today they cut a hill down like that and don't think a thing about it. But that was quite an operation, and everybody would stand around and watch and say, I don't see where they're going to do it, and I don't see how they're going to do it. It was like a builder's dream come true to cut that hill down. And it made Kaufman's store quite different from what it is today. And the same way with the Carnegie Building and those big buildings there. They could never have existed. In the courthouse, that's where I learned to ride a bicycle. In the courthouse, they have a yard inside. And mother had the boys buy me a bicycle. They took me down there in this yard and taught me to ride in the round and round in a circle. And other than that, you couldn't really learn because the streets were so busy with horses and wagons and traffic that was not easily maneuverable like an automobile, but you just had to learn there. So I learned to ride a bicycle. And I could ride from our house, which is on Wiley Avenue at that time, out to Shenley Park. And that was a big, hard trip to ride a bicycle that distance. But I never went alone. One of the boys always went with me because they didn't think I was able to go with the streetcars and the horses and buggies. But I did. I got out there all right. But oh, it was a hard job. When we lived on 6th Avenue at the across from the hotel, which is now the William Penn, the opposite side on 6th Avenue was the Sampson's Mortuary, which is now East End. And I was very well acquainted with the girl and the boy, the son and daughter, and we used to go over there and sneak and watch because we were told that when people were cremated that they would sit up in the coffin, and we wanted to see that, but it never happened. Women in those days wore very long skirts, mostly black, and they had what they called a train. It was so long that it touched the ground. You never saw a woman's leg or ankle because they wore high-buttoned shoes, and then if they had a dress of this type and were going in town, it had a ribbon attached that they would fasten on their wrist to hold it just so it held it just off the ground to keep from sweeping the dirt on the street. And the Davis Theater then was on Smithfield Street, and it had vaudeville. And Shenley Park on the 4th of July always had a wonderful display of fireworks, and everybody went. And you always would sit on a hill opposite where they showed the fireworks. And when the last piece was shown, it always said good night. And then everybody would scramble to get away from it and get away from the crowd and get home on the streetcar. And St. Paul's Cathedral, which is now at 5th Avenue and Craig Street, was on the corner of Grant Street and 5th Avenue and was burned down. We had the first roller skating rink in Pittsburgh at that time. It was across the street from Horns, where the Sun Dirt Company is now. The theater, and there was a theater, their Thames Theater, very well known at that time, was where Rosenbaum's formerly was, at the corner of Penn and, that's Penn and 6th Avenue. But that was taken down too, and then Rosenbaum's was built. But now Rosenbaum's has been destroyed too, and they're putting a parking lot there. If you went to the store for meat, a butcher would never think of charging you for a soup bone or anything of that type. He always gave it to you gladly. And if a child went, he always offered her a piece of bologna or a wiener. And the bakeries did the same thing. Always were handing out cookies and things. But nowadays, you don't get anything like that. That's about all I remember, Eddie, at the time.